radio station KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, open daily December 18th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade arts, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at Southwest Ankeny and NATO Parkway in Waterfront Park. Information at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll get an update on the City of Portland's plan to implement federally mandated changes in the Portland Police Department.
President Obama's panel on the National Security Agency has released its recommendations without admitting that the agency broke any laws.
And Senator Wyden has announced a plan to vastly increase the amount of logging allowed in Oregon forests.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 19th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today, the New Mexico Supreme Court announced that the state of New Mexico is constitutionally bound to recognize same-sex marriages, making it the 17th state to recognize marriage equality. Approximately 1,000 same-sex couples have already been married in New Mexico. In March, six same-sex couples filed a lawsuit seeking the right to marry. By August, a district court judge in Albuquerque ordered clerks to begin issuing marriage licenses to gay couples. County clerks in New Mexico intervened, asking the state Supreme Court to resolve the issue, and arguments were heard on October 23rd. The ruling stated that legislation barring individuals from marrying and depriving them of the rights, protections, and responsibilities of civil marriage solely because of their sexual orientation violates the Equal Protection Clause under Article 2, Section 18 of the New Mexico State Constitution. An appeal of the ruling is unlikely. The 33 county clerks represented by the New Mexico Association of Counties stated that their job was not to delve into politics, but to uphold the law and the development of the state's marriage laws. Next year, one of the biggest battles in the struggle for marriage equality is likely to be in Oregon, where gay marriage proponents hope to overturn the state's ban.
Bankers Life and Casualty Company has been fined for $115,000 for improper claims handling by the Oregon Insurance Division. Along with being fined, the company must review roughly 26,000 denied claims that involve over 2,000 policyholders dating back to January 2010 to find out where the company owes benefits. Because long-term care insurers, like Bankers Life, usually pay bills for monthly services, one policyholder can have more than one claim. If they disagree with the findings, the policyholders can request a review by an arbitrator. The order that was given with the fine requires the company to hire an industry professional who is approved by the insurance division to review specific claims. Bankers Life must also provide a detailed plan within 60 days that tells how they plan to review the claims and a corrective plan on how to properly handle claims they receive in the future. The company, worth approximately $13 million in 2012, is ranked one of the worst among 20 long-term care insurance companies.
Yesterday, the City Council unanimously agreed to adopt an agreement with the Portland Police Association, or PPA, on a labor contract and federal reforms demanded by the U.S. Department of Justice, which had been hashed out over several months. The council also heard testimony on proposed reforms to the Independent Police Review Division of the City Auditor's Office, or IPR, reforms which were left out of the larger agreement. The president of the police union, Daryl Turner, also spoke before the vote on the IPR reforms, stating that if the council were to approve them, he would file an unfair labor practices complaint with the Oregon Employment Relations Board, since the city would be making changes without negotiating with the union. The council postponed the vote until January 8th. Many advocates for stronger reforms want the vote postponed even further until after a fairness hearing by a federal judge in February. In this excerpt from yesterday's public comments, Kristen Chambers of the National Lawyers Guild and the Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes of the Albina Ministerial Alliance give several reasons for postponing the vote in an effort to strengthen the IPR's role in police discipline.
Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Chambers. I'm here on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild. We strongly believe that council should delay their vote on this IPR ordinance until after the fairness hearing for a number of reasons. One, the six recommendations that I sat here and proposed on October 23rd, of those, only one of them has been addressed and was already kind of an issue that was floating around before that hearing. One of the things mentioned by one of you, I forget who, at that hearing was wanting to know more from the community about why people don't file complaints, why there's a lack of trust in the system, what is really going on in the community. And I think the fairness hearing is the opportunity for people in the community to come forward and share their testimony. The judge will be accepting testimony in writing and by video, and it will be a really good opportunity for you all to hear back from the community members and learn more about what is actually going on and what actually needs to be addressed in this ordinance. I'm also here to follow up on the memo that the NLG submitted to you on December 6th regarding the issue of compelling officer testimony. I noticed section 3.21.220 added some new language about compelling testimony, and there, I had just a couple of concerns about it. One, I'm not really sure why subsection D is necessary. It allows a representative of the Bureau to just attend the interview. I'm not sure what their role would be there. It seems to me that that would further detract from the independentness of the investigation if a Bureau member is just there present. And it doesn't seem necessary to me to have that person present there.
I am the Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes, chairperson of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. Conceptually, it is crucial for the city of Portland to have a transparent, independent, accessible, empowered review process. To be able to build trust between the Portland Police Bureau and the citizens of the community of Portland, especially community of colors and persons with mental health issues who have been the victims of police deadly force and excessive force. Hence, we support many of the changes recommended by the auditor's office and IPR, but we also believe that they do not go far enough to change the lack of power in the independent review and the ability to hold officers accountable for violating the policy, the training, and the rights of citizens. It is not enough to just have an internal police review board within the department. If we are to make the Department of Justice of Agreement a reality, the component of an independent, transparent review board is a necessity to build trust in our city. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
After the fairness hearing in February, U.S. Judge Michael Simon cannot propose individual changes to the agreement between the city and the police union, but he can throw it out completely, which would force the two sides back to the bargaining table and give stronger reforms another chance to be considered. For more on the current reform proposals and the disciplinary process as it currently stands, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Constantine Severe, director of the Independent Police Review Division.
One of the changes that's been made to the proposed reforms has been, I believe you went from requesting that the IPR be able to directly compel officer testimony to having a police liaison do that?
Yes, sir.
And why was that a necessary change?
You have to get into the murky area of Oregon public employee law, but basically for a public entity to compel an employee, so basically say you have to be here and answer your questions about this particular subject, the entity that does that has to be the entity that has the ability to hire or discharge or fire or terminate, discipline an employee. So here at the City of Portland, the Independent Police Review Division, we're not part of the Police Bureau. We're part of the City Auditor's Office. So we don't have the ability to hire or fire officers. The city code has never granted us that ability. That's not really our role. Our role is an investigative functioning, monitoring function. So for us to be able to do an investigation when it required us to talk to officers, and for that to be something that would stick if it went to arbitration later on, we would need a police bureau liaison, since the police bureau is the entity that hires and fires police officers.
And so would it be possible for that liaison to refuse to compel that testimony?
The way the city code is structured, no. What we're trying to do with that particular provision is clear up some ambiguity in the city code right now. The way it is written, there's kind of two different versions. So one version says that if a collective bargaining agreement does apply, IPR has to, when it does an investigation that needs the interview and an officer, we are supposed to relay our questions through a police bureau liaison, and that liaison is supposed to basically repeat our question word for word to the police bureau officer that we're trying to interview, and we can't talk to them directly. And then the other prong of that is that if a collective bargaining agreement doesn't apply, then we can just ask our question directly. Given that nuance, we have developed a practice in collaboration with the police bureau of us, when we need to talk directly to officers, the police bureau compels the officer, provides the constitutionally required admonishment, and then we talk to the officer directly and ask our questions. So that's what we're trying to have in city code, because it's important that members of the public understand what we are doing when we talk directly to officers and just generally in our investigative function. And so that's all that is. It's not some sort of creating a brand new thing. IPR has had the ability to conduct an independent investigation since it was created in 2001, and we've done that a few times in the last year.
What effect do you have on Police Chief Reese's actual disciplinary decisions?
So our role is to, we take in community member complaints about police officer misconduct. We do the initial investigation. Our office has to approve every investigation, whether we do it or if the police bureau does it, which is the majority of the time. We have to approve the police bureau investigation, and we have to approve the recommended finding that the officer's commander does initially. And then if the case goes to the police review board, which is a disciplinary board that hears cases of discipline of a day or more, we are a voting member on that board. But once it goes to the police chief and the police commissioner, normally the mayor, and currently Mayor Hales is the police commissioner, they have the discretion per city code and just the way our commissioner form of government works of making their own independent decision on whether, how they want to go on findings and discipline.
In the city council meeting earlier in the morning, there was an agreement reached or formalized between the city and the police union over several bargaining points.
Yeah.
And one of those was a discipline matrix. And so that's sort of to keep disciplinary actions consistent.
Exactly. Consistent, objective, transparent, fair, that everybody knows if an officer does X behavior, they're going to get Y as a consequence.
But that's also advisory, so Reese could deviate from it.
Yes. The discipline guide is a management tool. The chief could decide to go in a different direction. He would have to provide a rationale for that reason.
What role can citizens play in this? What kind of control do they have over their own police department?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the community plays an important role, several different functions. You know, one, if they see an officer do something that they don't like, they can file a complaint with our office. Or, you know, the converse, if they do see something that they do like, they can file a commendation. The other part is the Citizens Review Committee, which is an advisory body to us. They hear appeals when community members file a complaint and they don't like the way the case turned out. And they also just generally monitor the police bureau.
Constantine, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Sure, yeah, thank you.
This is Sam Bowman speaking with Constantine Sevier, Director of the Independent Police Review Division of the City Auditor's Office.
Legislation for managing Eastern Oregon's six national forests has been in the works since the year 2009 and has passed through a Senate committee today. But conservation groups are angry about last-minute changes by the bill's sponsor and the committee chairman, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, changes that they say will gut environmental protections. For more on this story, we go to KBOO's Genevieve McDaniel in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Senator Ron Wyden has made some last-minute changes to his Oregon East Side Forest Restoration Bill, changes that have left the conservation community stunned and disappointed. What was touted as a historic compromise for forest management, shepherded by Wyden, now contains language limiting the definition of old growth to trees more than 200 years of age, cutting out some stream and watershed protections, and more. Steve Pedry, with Oregon Wild, says it isn't all what was agreed to in years of negotiations about the future of the six national forests in eastern Oregon.
We had hoped, you know, we would have a bill that set this model, that we would work to restore environmental health and produce timber as a byproduct. Having a Democratic senator from Oregon pushing legislation that says we're going to log trees up to 200 years old to pay for timber sales, to essentially subsidize the timber industry, that's not a good precedent to have out there.
Senate Bill 1301 gets a markup in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee today, where Wyden is chairman. Six conservation groups have sent a letter to Wyden and the committee members outlining their objections and asking that the bill be set aside until what they call an acceptable solution can be found. Exactly 4 years ago this week, Wyden and representatives of the timber industry and environmental groups shook hands and announced the timber wars were over as a result of this legislation. But it's been stuck in Congress since then, and Pedry thinks Wyden made the changes to appease Republicans on his committee rather than the Oregonians who worked on the agreement.
We understand the desire to want to get something done, but we should be trying to get the right thing done, you know, rather than gut a really important piece of legislation like this. Just to satisfy folks who are opposed to environmental conservation.
This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
Two reports released today have criticized the government's response to multiple recent outbreaks of salmonella in chicken and found that nearly all chicken sold in U.S. supermarkets contained strains of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The reports come in the midst of a salmonella outbreak linked to chicken from Foster Farms, the nation's sixth largest chicken producer. Oregon and Washington health authorities were the first to pick up on the Foster Farms salmonella outbreak earlier this year. One of today's reports was produced by Pew Charitable Trust, which reviewed the U.S. Department of Agriculture's response to the salmonella outbreaks and found that the agency has not done enough to protect public health. The report's authors called for more inspectors to conduct random testing and order mandatory recalls. Earlier this month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture called on the poultry industry to voluntarily limit the use of antibiotics, but critics say a voluntary measure does not go far enough. The other study, published today by Consumer Reports, indicated that most chickens sold in U.S. marketplaces are contaminated. The Consumer Reports group tested over 300 raw chicken breasts from nationwide retail outlets for six bacteria and for antibiotic resistance. The results showed that about all of the samples were contaminated, including the organic ones, and nearly half were tainted with antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Over 60% of the samples were contaminated with fecal matter, including all major brands of chicken: Perdue, Pilgrim's, Sanderson Farms, and Tyson.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with Marco Mejia of Jobs with Justice, who will explain their picks for Scrooge of the Year after this newscast. This will be followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a 90% chance of precipitation, including some ice pellets. The high will be 41 and a low of 32 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 31 counts per minute in North Portland, high of 57. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 33 CPM with a high of 55. Powell Butte out there measures 27 CPM with a high of 44. And Sitka up in Alaska has a radiation count of 32 counts per minute with spikes as high as 54. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information on this can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's a scary world out there with global terrorists plotting to kill us. That's why we must be grateful to the National Security Agency and our Department of Homeland Security. They're constantly on watch, poised to spring to our defense, no matter from what hellhole the threat emanates. Some homegrown cynics say the billions a year we spend on these two agencies of eternal vigilance is wasted. Yeah? Well, let me rub the noses of those cynics in the dangerous mess right in our own midst that was uncovered and efficiently, dare I say heroically, dealt with by the proud patriots of NSA and DHS. I speak of LibertyManiacs.com, a diabolical website run by a fiend named Dan McCall. Yes, McCall is an American, but apparently he's been recruited to the dark side, for he's issuing communistic-style propaganda that hurts the efforts of our anti-terror heroes. Or at least, it's hurting their feelings. Specifically, Dan's been selling T-shirts, coffee cups, and other paraphernalia with slogans that mock the two massive spook agencies. For example, one calls DHS the Department of Homeland Stupidity. Another says, NSA, the only part of government that actually listens. And one even alters the NSA's official logo to read, Peeping While You're Sleeping. Top spooks at NSA and DHS were outraged, and both agencies took legal action to try stopping McCall from, well, from making fun of them. Technically, though, that's not against the law, not yet. So the agencies had to go after him for, quote, mutilation or impersonation of government seals. This is Jim Hightower saying, it turns out that McCall's politics are not at all lefty, but instead way out in right field. However, who cares? When powerful agencies try to outlaw parody, that's neither left nor right. It's straight up stupid.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
As Oregon's unemployment rate continues to decline to its lowest point since September of 2008, it still stands above the national rate of 7%. Historically, and in a better economy, Oregon's average unemployment rate has been about 6.5%, but in September of 2008, it was still above 7%. Many industries have had large job gains over the last year. Industries such as the trade, transportation, and utilities have added 1,800 jobs. Professional and business services have gained about 1,000 jobs. And in November, the retail job market added over 2,000 jobs, which was above the normal for the seasonal expectations.
20,000 people across the state of Oregon are set to lose their unemployment benefits at the end of the month after Republicans blocked an effort by House Democrats to extend the benefits into next year. Representatives Blumenauer, Bonamici, and DeFazio today released a list that shows how many people will lose their benefits in each Oregon county. Multnomah County tops the list, with over 3,600 people set to lose unemployment benefits. Oregon representatives in the U.S. Congress have called for an emergency measure to extend the federal emergency unemployment compensation program. The extension was originally included in the budget bill, but was cut in an attempt to appease Republicans. Also cut from the budget was an extension of benefits for military veterans. The White House Council of Economic Advisers has estimated that the failure to extend federal unemployment insurance will end up costing the economy 240,000 jobs nationwide.
A jury has found BP engineer Kurt Mix guilty of obstruction of justice for his role in destroying evidence during the investigation of the largest oil spill in U.S. history. BP took responsibility for the Deepwater Horizon disaster and so far has been ordered to pay $4 billion in penalties. But none of the owners of the company seem to be in danger of doing prison time. Kurt Mix, on the other hand, faces up to 20 years in prison because he was caught deleting texts implicating him. He apparently knew that the plan to dump mud on the hemorrhaging oil leak would not work because of the rate at which the oil was spilling. When he had to turn his smartphone in to federal investigators, he deleted texts warning colleagues that the flow rate, or the amount of oil being spilled, was 15,000 barrels per day. This was three times more than what BP was telling the public at the time. The Department of Justice says the potential 20-year sentence stems from their zero-tolerance policy for people who destroy evidence.
A petition this week on rootsaction.org is calling on the Washington Post to sever its ties with the Central Intelligence Agency, and it's already garnered over 15,000 signatures. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Robert McChesney, a communications professor at the University of Illinois who has extensively studied the influence of money on politics and the media.
Can you start by talking about the revelations that have just been coming out about potential CIA connections and the Washington Post?
Well, I don't think it's actually potential. It's acknowledged that the owner of the Washington Post, Jeff Bezos, who is also the founder and main shareholder in Amazon, his Amazon has a $600 million contract with the CIA to provide cloud services for CIA data. So that's not potential. That's an actually existing and acknowledged commercial relationship.
Well, Norman Solomon has also written a piece this week talking about this issue, and he says that this is indicating the importance of independent media. Do you think that that is the way out, or is there a way to make the Washington Post responsive to the needs of the people in the U.S.?
I think that Norman Solomon is exactly right. What this points to is something that the founders of this country understood, which is you're going to have a credible press system. It can't be part of commercial empires. It can't have strings attached to what it does. A genuinely free and independent press has to be independent. It has to be basically in the service of doing journalism. It can't have other masters to serve. And the Washington Post right now has a lot of other masters to serve. I mean, it's basically a plaything for Jeff Bezos. And Jeff Bezos is not interested in politics because he's some dilettante, he's a dabbler, he just wants to goof around. His company, Amazon, has enormous political issues at stake in Washington that will determine the future and very existence of the company. Amazon's a monopoly. So he's got to deal with he's got to make sure the government doesn't enforce antitrust law. Amazon depends on very low-paid labor at its warehouses in the United States and around the world. So it's crucial to Jeff Bezos that labor law not be strengthened, that the labor unions continue to be weak and ineffectual so they don't organize his workers. Jeff Bezos wants to have a global markets. He's battling for it. So it's key to him that the U.S. government be his private security force overseas, advocating his interests. So Jeff Bezos, when he owns the Washington Post, it's not to make money off the Post, but it's to use the Post ultimately to enhance the profitability of Amazon. And I think in that sense it was a very smart investment for Bezos, but not a very good outcome for the people of the country.
Well, at the same time, there are journalists in the Washington Post that have integrity and want to actually report the news. What's going to be the impact for them?
That's a good question, and you're absolutely right. The Washington Post has some of the best reporters in the country. Dana Priest, for example, is the reporter who broke much of our stuff years ago, long before WikiLeaks, long before Edward Snowden, on the exact size and dimensions of the national security complex and the amount of spying that's going on. She's terrific, and there are other reporters of that caliber, too. It's going to be a really interesting question to see how much leeway reporters like that have, how much that sort of work is encouraged. But again, I don't think we should romanticize what the Washington Post was prior to Jeff Bezos buying it. The Dana Priests of the world stuck out because they were so anomalous. They were the exceptions that proved the rule. Track record of the Washington Post on foreign policy issue after issue after issue going back decades now has been pretty much to toe the government line and to keep the debate firmly within the range of debate that's legitimated by the leadership of the two political parties.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Robert McChesney. He is a professor of communications at the University of Illinois, responding to a petition that's been put together this week at rootsaction.org saying the Washington Post coverage of the CIA should include full disclosure that the sole owner of the Post is also the main owner of Amazon, and Amazon is now gaining huge profits directly from the CIA. Thanks for joining us, Robert McChesney.
My great pleasure.
And that petition, again, is at rootsaction.org. I'm Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
An early release of President Obama's NSA review panel report makes broad policy recommendations, but it does not address whether or not current federal data mining and storage is legal. Members of the advisory group said the recommendations were intended to provide public reassurances rather than actually dismantling NSA surveillance programs. The panel seemed to find current policies regarding surveillance and data collection within federal authority, and they did not call into question the persistent abuses of noncompliance to FISA rules. The report makes no reference at all to enforcement mechanisms. Instead, it suggests that recommendations for the private collection of records by communications companies would relieve the federal government from maintaining them and resolve the problem of government surveillance on its own citizens. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden sees the recommendations as substantive and meaningful, and that they can make internet communications more secure rather than undermining security standards. However, critics of the recommendations, such as ACLU Legislative Counsel Michelle Richardson, say that, quote, nothing short of stopping the mass suspicionless surveillance of Americans is acceptable.
Payphones across America are disappearing as the advancement of cell phone technology takes over, but that could be a problem for the many who rely upon them. In 2000, there were over 2 million payphones, but now just over 240,000 stand on street corners and in public areas such as plazas. Last year in Rochester, New York, about 264,000 calls were placed from payphones, the equivalent of a phone being used once every 4 days. For the phone to make profit, though, it needs 80 to 100 calls a month. The company that operates most of the payphones in that region commented that last year, 3,500 free calls to 411 and 911 were made, and this year there have been nearly 5,200. Payphones are nevertheless a dying species. This leaves the 3 million households in America that don't have access to a landline or cell phone at a loss. Residents in some of those households end up borrowing a cell phone or using a payphone, and without the payphones, won't have access to a phone at all.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, late yesterday, Taliban fighters wearing army uniforms attacked U.S. military vehicles in a parking lot. They killed at least one policeman and they torched several trucks. The car bomb exploded outside the entrance to the Torkham Gate, a key crossing into Pakistan for NATO supplies, which are leaving Afghanistan as the U.S.-led coalition withdraws. During the three-hour fight with security forces, one policeman was killed and five were wounded, according to Nangarhar provincial spokesman Ahmad Zia Abdulzai. All attackers who had military uniforms on were killed. A Taliban statement claimed that their fighters had torched more than 30 U.S. military vehicles.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, December 18, 2013. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities, clash with local residents and injure a child, and kidnap other civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday morning the town of Beit Umar near the southernmost bank city of Hebron, injured one child and kidnapped a young man. Local sources announced that troops invaded the town and kidnapped a young man, then clashed with residents and fired tear gas into residents' homes. Omar Abu Aisha, 13 years old, was injured when a tear gas fired by Israeli soldiers exploded inside his family home. Ayash was injured in the head and moved to a nearby hospital in Hebron City. Elsewhere, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded Silwan town and the old city of occupied East Jerusalem, kidnapped five Palestinians, including three children. Nasser Kos, head of the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that the occupied Jerusalem is facing a large-scale campaign that includes invasions targeting several neighborhoods in the occupied city. Six more Palestinians have been kidnapped in the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops invaded Nablus and the nearby Ain and Askar refugee camps, then searched and ransacked a number of homes. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, December 18, 2013, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please keep visiting our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kari Franzen, Genevieve McDaniel, and Ginny Kanjus. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers. If you have a pen or something to write with, the local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386, and Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, hosts Ani and Lynn celebrate and honor the upcoming winter solstice. At 9, on Veterans Voice, Marvin, Bill, and Arlene interview Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, about what the U.S. government knew about how the attack on Pearl Harbor would happen. At 10 on Air Cascadia, host Chris Andre speaks with Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights about Michael Leonard, the American general in charge of opening the Guantanamo Bay prison camp, who is now in favor of closing it. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, host Justin Miller speaks with renowned author Salman Rushdie about his latest work, Joseph Anton, a memoir, an intimate look at his life in hiding dying from death threats after the publication of the Satanic Verses. And at 11:45, we hear from Ben Rivers, a musician and composer from Berkeley who has early-onset Parkinson's disease and aims to share how he came to find the humor and dignity in the midst of the disease. Thanks to you KBOO members for your generous support for community radio. Not a member? That's okay. You can become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for an interview with Marco Mejia of Jobs for Justice, conducted by KBOO's Jenka Soderbergh. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Jen.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
We are joined on the line by Marco Mejia with Jobs with Justice here in Portland, and we're going to talk about the Scrooge of the Year Awards that were held this past weekend, who the candidates were, and who ended up winning the Scrooge of the Year here locally. But first, talk about what is the Scrooge of the Year and why Jobs with Justice decided to have this annual award ceremony.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, it's a tradition already of a number of years that we have every year, and we thought that it is important to highlight and to continue the struggle, also giving some sort of award to the people, the bosses, the ones that are attempting against the rights of workers and families and community. So and make it public so that everyone knows about them. So we created this Scrooge, as in everyone knows what the Scrooge is, right? Hates kids, hates happiness, and actually the Scrooge, we think that it's going to be is better than some of the ones that are the candidates. Anyway, so what we do is elect and get candidates around, you know, town from the member organizations of Jobs with Justice, and we elect the worst of the worst. So we have a corporate style election. That is the way that we do it. And, of course, we use democracy as we do it in the United States. So the election, you know, you can buy the votes and you can buy the elections. So we sell the votes, and the winner is the one that sells more votes. And that's the way we do it.
So you use it as a bit of a fundraiser for Jobs with Justice as well.
Exactly. So thank you. It's one of our fundraisers every year, and it's a very fun party. People like it a lot, and because it's a fun thing, you know, we elect, we have a role play kind of thing that people present the candidate, actually, or the candidates, and it's a very fun event where people come, have food, drinks, meet with other activists and other people in the community, and have a chance to elect Scrooge.
So this took place this past weekend here in Portland, and we're going to hold the listeners in suspense as to who actually won this year's Scrooge of the Year, and we'll talk about who the candidates were, and you can guess who ended up being the Scrooge of the Year, and we'll let you in on that in a few minutes. But Erica Bricks, Portland District Supervisor for the U.S. Postal Service, responsible for overseeing the closure of the Salem processing plant. Yvonne Deckard won a no-bid $15,000 a month contract from Portland Public Schools. Coin TV, failure to bargain in good faith and sending jobs to anti-union state Indiana. The Portland Business Alliance was on the nominee list here. The Climate Jobs Committee nominated the Portland Business Alliance for having a board of directors that are among the world's worst polluters and financiers of polluting industries, and Sheriff Staton, who changed policy to ensure that ICE holds are only honored in the case of violent and aggravated crimes, but has begun to ignore his own policy. So let's talk about these candidates. Let's talk about Erica Bricks, the Portland District Supervisor for the U.S. Postal Service. How did she get on the list?
Well, you know that what's going on with the Postal Service, the Congress and some of the politicians and corporate world that does that kind of work want to get rid of the Postal Service little by little. So they're trying to cut days of work. They have been already closing down processing plants and et cetera, et cetera. All of that is happening, right, in a context that many of those politicians are talking about creating jobs, and what they're doing with this is really actually destroying hundreds of thousands of jobs And then, of course, in the future, they're going to create jobs with low wages, you know, for all the companies that will take up the postal work. So in Portland, there's a campaign going on, you know, and trying to get to the postal service, you know, the executives, and talk to them and tell them, you know, why it is the wrong thing to do. And well, Erica Briggs is the one that is, I think, the manager, the local here in Oregon, and she has been refusing to meet with the community and to the people that are, you know, running the campaign and the workers of the postal service. So I think that that's why she deserves that.
And I understand that also some community members went to her office to try and meet with her, and she had them arrested.
Yeah, well, you know, every time that they do go to any, just like any postal service, you know, or processing plant, people have been arrested, pretty much. And she has been refusing to meet, even when people come to talk to her.
Wow. And, of course, the real irony being that the U.S. Postal Service is a profitable organization and has good wage union jobs, but is being forced by a mandate from Congress to pay for health benefits for workers 75 years in advance, the only public or private institution that is required to do that. And the supporters of the post office say that is a political bid by those in Congress to try to shut the Postal Service down or to privatize it. So that's Erica Briggs, Portland District Supervisor for the U.S. Postal Service. Also on the list for Scrooge of the Year is Yvonne Deckard. Now, who is Yvonne Deckard, and how did she make the list?
Well, she made the list is because she is representing, you know, Portland Public Schools, and she's the person that is the consultant that, as you said in the beginning, you know, she gets $15,000 a month wages. And an institution that don't want to pay teachers to do the hard work that they do every month. And what she's doing is pretty much, you know, coming to advise how to really take the school system and the Portland Public Schools, you know, to a different stage and level, you know. Advising, as you know, in the United States here in Portland, there's all these forces of corporate world again, you know, that's going through the fabrics of every place in our communities, in our life, that also education, it's one of those, and they want to make it also, you know, into the dynamics of the corporate world and make it, you know, profitable. So they are trying to demonstrate, you know, in the big context, that the school doesn't work, that the teachers are bad, and that they need to make changes. And those changes are, you know, to create more charter schools, that they are independent, and they have the directors of these schools will be business-oriented people, that because that's what they're saying, that they need a kind of administrators. And workers will have, you know, or won't have the opportunity to organize themselves, and will be, you know, lowering down, you know, the standards and the wages also for workers. So what Yvonne Deckard is doing there is she is the advisor of those things, you know, and she gets a lot of money. That's what it's, you know, moving all of these, actually behind all of it, you know. And also, you know, Yvonne Deckard, she is already collecting also more extra money, as I understand, you know, $10,800 a month from PERS, you know.
Retirement system in, here in Oregon. Yes. She's also a consultant there.
Yeah, well, exactly. So it's that kind of thing. It's a good friend with the board of directors. I mean Smith, you know, what's her name? Carol Smith, the superintendent, you know, they're friends. You know, and she gave the job to her friend, which is Yvonne Deckard. So things work around that level, you know. So that's why she deserves also you know, the cruise of the year.
So this cronyism in the school administration of the Portland Public School District, which is right now facing a potential strike from the teachers because they have been refusing to negotiate on some of the teachers' pretty moderate demands to keep class sizes low and to allow the teachers to actually have good wage union jobs that will allow them to teach students as well as they possibly can. So Yvonne Deckard, I said a $15,000 contract. That's $15,000 a month from the Portland Public Schools. She's already gotten $360,000 from Portland Public Schools as a labor consultant, or rather anti-labor consultant, and is also making more than $10,000 a month from a public employment retirement system here in Oregon. So Yvonne Deckard on the list for Scrooge of the Year. Next on the list, Coin TV. How did Coin TV make the list?
Well, Coin TV, you know, they also have been having difficulties, you know, with the union that represents them as CWA, the Communication Workers of America. And what they tend to do is pretty much, you know, like any other corporation, get rid of the union and get workers that are vulnerable, that they don't say anything and they can't treat them the way they want. So they already fired, I think it's six or workers. What they are doing now, it's and that's the way that they are weakening the union and their strength there, is that they are outsourcing some of the jobs that they do. And it's interesting because, you know, nowadays with technology, you know, they outsource jobs to outside the United States even, but in this case, you know, they're outsourcing some things that they can bring to a different state. So in that way, you know, you have workers in a different state, and locally you have other workers that are weakened, you know, and they are losing, you know, some of the members for the union. So Coin TV deserves the Scrooge of the Year because they are, you know, union busters, and they are firing already. They did fire already some of the workers, and they're doing anything they can with outsourcing those jobs to destroy the union.
Well, and it's interesting. It's supposed to be a local news channel producing local news, and some of these jobs are editors, producers, and people who are involved in putting together this local newscast are now being outsourced to other states, or even, as you said, to other countries in order to pay them lower wages. So that's Coin TV. Portland Business Alliance also made the list. What is the Portland Business Alliance doing this year that put them on the potential Scrooge of the Year award list?
Well, they came up because, you know, the committee that is called the Climate Jobs Committee nominated them just to put it out, you know, who they represent. And the Portland Business Alliance, you know, board of directors, as you said before, are some of the world's worst polluters. So in financiers, polluting industries. So they don't really care about the environment. What they care is about the profits of their members, you know. And in that sense, but not just that, I think that they have been or trying to create a divide in between, you know, the labor movement and jobs and the workers, and that they don't have much to do with the environment, taking care of the environment, which is wrong and is not true. So what they were trying to do is to you know, expose that, you know, and expose that the myth is that one, that, you know, the labor actually it cares about the environment. And that's why they deserve it, you know, because they're the ones that represent these corporations and groups that are polluting our water locally, you know, are polluting the air, etc. So they do reserve this Scrooge of the Year.
And last but not least, we've got Sheriff Staton, who was put on the list for his role in deportations and immigration issues here locally. And maybe you could share some background about that.
Yeah, well, Sheriff Staton, you know, he's an elected official. At the same time, it's important for people to understand that we still live in the Wild West era with our sheriff. So he's elected, but, you know, in the county, he has his own domain. And he sets his policy. He decides what he wants or what he doesn't want. And he decides what's going on in the jail and with the county police department. It's interesting because we have the county commissioners, the ones that are supposed to oversee the county and everything and the services that goes on in there. They do not. They cannot do anything with the sheriff. So it's interesting, in a democratic country, in a democratic city, we have that kind of situation. So he sets his own policy, and he believed in the beginning that he needs to comply with what ICE, which is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Police, it's telling them to do, which is to impose, you know, they have been asking other police departments throughout the nation to share the information with them, and also to, at the same time, you know, when they place an ICE hold, that they collaborate with the local police collaborates with ICE. And that's what Sheriff Staton has been doing, even though it is not a mandatory. But he has been refusing and not understanding that is not mandatory, but because he wants, for some reason, to continue doing that and collaborating with ICE. For some fear, maybe, you know, political fear, or also I think that he was afraid of losing some funds, which wasn't true. Funds that come from the federal government wasn't true. But anyway, so at the end, you know, after so much work in the community, organizing and trying to make him understand that that's not mandatory, that he can, as he does, you know, set his own policy, he can change that. Finally, because of pressure, he changed his mind and said that he can do just halfway, kind of. So now that he's not going to place ice holes on people that have lower, you know, crimes and misdemeanors, but it's going to be especially for violent crimes. So that happened. We agree with that. Well, I mean, we don't agree that should happen. We as a community, we think that there shouldn't be any collaboration, because that's kind of disrespecting even the local justice system. We do already have a system locally that deals with crime, that deals with all of this, with the courts and everything like that. So people in the community doesn't trust that system and doesn't trust the police anymore, because this is happening. Victims of crime, of domestic violence, or victims of any kind of crime, or people that see and witness crime, they're immigrants, or they have family members that are immigrants, and if they are undocumented, they're very afraid of calling the police, because if they call the police, it happened already that many of them have been identified as undocumented, and then many times the victims have been detained and then put an ice hold on them and then gone to Tacoma, which is the detention center locally, and then being deported.
So it actually makes our communities less safe in that victims of crimes end up afraid of reporting them for fear of being deported. And that's Sheriff Staton here locally. So we've got these nominees for the Scrooge of the Year with Jobs with Justice. And Marco Mejia, can you tell us who ended up being the recipient of the Scrooge of the Year, and how was that award delivered?
Well, so the Scrooge of the Year was elected, and it's the Union Bosses of Coin TV. Those are the ones that were elected with a majority of votes, as we explained how you can get to win. And so what that means is that they are going to get the award. So we do deliver it. And we are thinking about how to do it in a way that is going to be very public, and that it's, you know, how they deserve to have it, that everyone knows. So we are in the planning on that, of that, and in what way it's going to happen. So probably, you know, it has to be very public, and we're going to invite other media to come and present, you know, the deliverer of the award, because we do produce an award, and we will deliver it to them. So I cannot give you much details of that, but we will, because we are in the planning stages of that. But it will happen within, you know, the next 3-4 weeks. And when we have the plan, we will let people know and invite them to come and participate in it.
So that's Coin TV, who were awarded the Scrooge of the Year by Jobs with Justice for failure to bargain in good faith, for sending good jobs to anti-union state, and for more union-busting proposals to take away more jobs and jurisdiction. Thanks very much for joining us. I've been speaking with Marco Mejia with Jobs with Justice here in Portland. Their website, jwjpdx.org. That's jwjpdx.org. Thanks for being with us today, Marco.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News In Depth.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO supporters, we just sent you a card, so watch your mailbox. It's an opportunity to give a little more assistance at this time of year to your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Yep, tax time. That means that your donation makes a difference. And it'll really make a difference for KBOO because you can help us qualify for Oregon Cultural Trust matching funds. You can get more information about this on our website at kboo.fm/year-end-gift-2013.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
I had a dream that the only reason the employers were so powerful was that we were weak.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
Tune In, Turn On, and Remember is a monthly special program on the history of KBOO Community Radio, commemorating KBOO's 45th anniversary year. The last installment of this special series will be on December 24th at 6 p.m. And listen online to the full series at kboo.fm/tune-in-turn-on.
Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders, featuring the stories and songs of elders from the Native Nations who lived and still live along the Lewis and Clark Trail. I'm Arlie Neskai of the Diné Nation. In the next hour, we'll feature the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Indians. We'll hear about tribal efforts to preserve the huckleberry. We'll look at the tradition of drumming among the Warm Springs and explore the fight against diabetes. We'll also examine the work of master basket weaver Pat Courtney Gold. But first, we'll hear from Elder Adeline Miller about her long and rich life of story and song on the reservation.
One little girl come in, and she says that she was an Indian. Well, why do you say that? Well, your skin is dark, and look at mine. That don't mean you're not an Indian. You're still Indian.
This is Wisdom of the Elders. Stay with us. This is Red Nativity, performing The Miracle of Life from the album Visions and Rhythms, Volume 2, on the Natural Visions label.